From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The testimony of Anita Hill by now has become iconic, or anyway, certain moments have. It was in October of 1991 when Hill gave surprising graphic testimony about how Clarence Thomas, who had been nominated to the Supreme Court, made inappropriate comments and unwanted sexual advances. And the testimony ignited a firestorm, a battle that was political and cultural. Anita Hill's testimony revealed the usually only whispered about issue of sexual harassment, but it also changed gender politics. Today in the program, we're live in Park City talking about a documentary that goes beyond Anita Hill's testimony. It's about her life and her sense of equality and home. Professor Hill will join us today, along with the director, Frieda Mock. The film is called Anita. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It was in October of 1991 when Professor Anita Hill gave surprising graphic testimony about how Clarence Thomas, who had been nominated to the Supreme Court, had made inappropriate comments and unwanted sexual advances. And the testimony, of course, ignited a firestorm. It was a battle that was political but also cultural. Professor Hill's testimony revealed the usually only whispered issue of sexual harassment, but it also changed gender politics. Today in the program, we're live in Park City here at the community radio station KPCW talking about a documentary that goes beyond Anita Hill's testimony. It's about her life and her sense of equality and her sense of home. Professor Hill is joining us today, along with the director, Frieda Mock, who says her documentary gets at some of the unresolved questions of 1991, like this one: what was really going on? The film is called Anita. It premiered on Saturday here at the Sundance Film Festival. There are two more screenings during the festival. We'll give you more details about that as we go along. Anita Hill is a professor of social policy, law, and women's studies at Brandeis University. She's the author of two books, Speaking Truth to Power and Reimagining Equality. And Professor Hill, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Frieda Mock, a filmmaker, director, writer, and producer. Among her films is Maya Lin, A Strong Vision. It's about the designer of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, earned an Academy Award for Best Feature Documentary. And Frieda Mock, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
I wanted to begin, Frieda Mock, if we could, with you, something that you have written about this film. You said that you thought the real story, when you were thinking about this, I guess right around the 20th anniversary, the real story had been lost. What did you mean by that? What did you figure had been lost?
I think what had been lost was that what was really going on in 1991. And I think the American public, I include myself, typical, who had reacted to the amazing testimony and just the kinds of people who were involved. It was just like wild theater we were watching over that weekend. Yeah. At the same time, I don't think we understood what was going on, because it was something that was was really a political battle that we just felt a confusion about.
Yeah.
And as I started to look into the story, I said, really, for me and for many people, Anita had such a profound impact on us personally, but also as a country in terms of public policy. And at the same time, we knew nothing about her. You know, who is she?
Yeah.
Why, how did she get there? What has happened to her? And what has been the impact of her work, the legacy of her work, and it's 20 years later? So I think there are a lot of questions to be explored in a story about the life and times of Anita Hill.
You've written that you wanted to go beyond the iconic moments of the hearing itself, which I wanted to ask you about, because what Professor Hill said, how she was treated, that was a critical and really dramatic part of the story. So, of course, you have to include those moments. You have to – and you do.
Yes.
To some degree in the film. But you also have to balance that against – as you said, Anita Hill, Professor Hill's personal story. So how did you manage that, and how did you balance that? I mean, how much did you want to spend on that actual moment in Washington, which I expect Professor Hill's tired of seeing from time to time? Professor Hill, I'll ask you about this here in just a second, but Frieda Mock, you first on that question.
Yeah. Well, I felt that Because I really wanted to find out, or to really explore who she is now. What has she done with, you know, what happened to her? Really, really, I mean, obviously her family, her friends know very much about her. And I, in doing the research and obviously reading fully and with great attention to her book, I mean, I think it was out there. But unless you read her book, you didn't realize certain things had happened to her. Paying close attention, at least. Such things as what happened to her immediately after the hearings, yeah, to her life. That, you know, did she go back to being a professor of contracts and commercial law quietly, resuming her life? But it turns out it was astonishing to me to find how much there was this virulent attack on her for speaking truth to power. You know, what is it about what she did to engender this kind of reaction? And it didn't stop within the first week or 2 months or 5 months. It went on for years. Yeah. And how do you go on with your life given this constant, attack, or you need to be vigilant at the same time, live a normal life. So there are things I found out that just no one, the public was not aware of. And I thought this story would help us understand what happens to a private citizen who walks into the most political battle, second to the presidency.
Yeah.
And she's a private citizen, you know, who's just doing her job. You know, she was subpoenaed to testify. And so she's doing her job and trying to do to help us as a nation understand what it's like. What would help us understand what would make the best Supreme Court justice? This is really the issue of is this the best nominee for the job?
Professor Hill, there is there's this thing you say at some point in the film that you don't want it to end up, or this story, you don't want this story to end up being a punchline. So it did make me wonder, how do you think about when all of this is dredged up again, you know, the comments made by senators, because I do want to talk about it. It is part of the film. But how are you thinking about talking about it and going through that again?
That's why I think it was so important, the treatment of the hearings, the how much of the hearings we need to begin to understand so that we can talk about what happened in an intelligent and informed way. And it is an interesting balance that you have to make. Of course, we don't want to deal with the painful and really somewhat of absurd parts of it forever and in great detail, and there are plenty of those. But I think the film does give us an important look or relook at what happened in those hours of that weekend, of Columbus Day weekend, mm-hmm, in 1991. And it's important. And yes, it is hard to go back on a personal level. It's very difficult to go back. But it's important for us to understand why we are where we are today.
Yeah.
We have to understand how we got there. And we can't simply just say, well, let's start the story today and talk about issues of inequality, whether it's sexual harassment or the court or whatever. We really do deserve to know what are the details. We always want these sort of instant reactions, and we want to know what's going on right now. Mm. But history is important. And 20 years ago, it's a lifetime ago for some of the people born since then, or all of the people born since then. But it's not that long ago when we think about of the timing and where we are today. So I think, it was hard to go back, but it was important to go back.
Yeah.
And then it was important to go back and then link those things to where we are today.
Right. You know, it's interesting. There's a moment in the film where John Carr, he's an attorney, a friend of yours, Professor Hill, one of the four corroborating witnesses who were allowed to testify on your behalf during the hearing. And he raises in the film this really big question. It seems like almost kind of the essence of the question, at least early on. And that is, he wonders why it is that they would suggest you were in some way lying. I mean, why would you make up a story? And he came to the conclusion that it wasn't really about the truth. The essence of the question, though, was what was it about? Frieda Mock, you first. How did you – because this was an important question that you get it. Like, what is this all about?
Well, it's not about the truth. They were not – as I can tell from the Senate's questions and reactions and the opportunity they had to really understand the issue beforehand they weren't looking for the factual information. you have four corroborating witnesses who were privileged to hear what was going on at that time. One, they didn't want, perhaps they didn't understand. I'm not sure, because you have to ask them. Do they weigh evidence? Because we're not talking about a trial. We're talking about probable factual activity. And so therefore you don't use a criminal trial,
I think it seemed like a trial to you, though, didn't it, Professor?
It felt a lot like a trial to me, and I was the one on trial.
Yeah.
But the criminal standard, you're right. You don't use this beyond the reasonable doubt or, you know, standard in this kind of a public hearing. And I think one of the things that conclusions that I come to was that you have to kind of look back. The fact that they got my statement and they didn't want to do anything about it. So in a sense, one of the things that it was about for the senators was preserving their process. It was about keeping their process and giving the sense that they were in control and that they knew exactly what needed to be done to benefit the public and that they were completely in charge. And here was some kind of information that they had never even heard of before, and it was going to be disruptive. And I was disruptive, and they didn't want anybody who was going to be disruptive. And so it was about process over finding out the truth. And it was at some point about the politics of a judicial nomination more than finding the person who is the appropriate person to sit in judgment of the lives of people in this country. And so it was process. It was about, you know, it's a sort of judicial, someone would say, you know, theater.
It was
about those things much more than the truth. And naively, I didn't fully appreciate how much that was so, or those two things were really more important to them than what I had to say.
You know, it's interesting because there's a moment in the film, an exchange you have with the former senator, Arlen Specter. It's an exchange where you are trying to explain something to him and you get a sense that he doesn't get it, that he doesn't quite know what this process is about, that he is – and that was a theme in some way, or at least something that you had said, Professor Hill, about that they were – the quality of the questions was a really interesting part of all of that, because not only were they hostile that I suppose would be a given if, you know, if, because this is such a partisan sort of thing, but they were so uninformed. All, not just about their process, but it also seemed really uninformed about what is this sexual harassment thing?
They were uninformed about sexual harassment, and they were also uninformed about the reality of people's experience. I don't think they had taken any time to understand that there really is a connection between what I was talking about and an individual's judicial integrity. Mm. And so they couldn't, to the extent that we give anyone the benefit of the doubt, we can say that they didn't understand. They really didn't get it. They were trying to get it, but they didn't. Well, of course, that's one interpretation. The other interpretation was that they didn't even care if they got it. They didn't want it to get it. They just wanted to discredit me enough that they could end the hearing. And I think that was Senator Specter's approach, that he just wanted to get me off the scene so that they can move forward and have the vote that they wanted to have. And then they could go on doing business as usual. And I think they counted on that. But the women of America and some men said, no, it's not over. You can, you know, you can bang the gavel, Joe Biden. You can say it's over. But we've got a different story that we're going to take. We're going to take this a different place than even you had imagined it would go.
Yeah.
I think they actually expressed it really politically in the 1992 election, that there was a groundswell.
The year of the woman.
I mean, really, that really it was the American people, women and men, who said they didn't like what they heard. They didn't like the frustration and the powerlessness that they felt from that process. And it was insulting, I think, perhaps, that they didn't get the full information. And they did. They were loud and clear in 1992. Both on the presidential level and on the congressional level. So in one sense, I think if you looked at the hearing, they were rather dismissive, very dismissive of what Anita brought in a serious way to hopefully help them understand, to help them do their job about evaluating the character and fitness of this nominee.
Well, let's remind people of the optics, I guess is the word that they use. Here's a black woman sitting in front of 14 middle-aged white men. And this wasn't that long ago.
No.
It's interesting to see it now and see all the women running around behind the men doing what I expect is most of the work.
But
it wasn't that long ago,
no,
Professor
20
Hill.
No, 20 years is nothing in one sense.
And there they were, just a committee full of men. I thought that was really
interesting. And I think that is one of the things that's beauty of having this film is that we can see, again, the optics. And when 2013 sensibilities, we could see that they're all there. And we thought nothing in 1991 of the fact that our representative body of 100 people, that in that body there were only two women. And none of them were even in that committee room. And so that there were only two women senators at the time. And the fact is that we hadn't really thought much about what that meant in terms of the way we were being governed, perhaps until that hearing made it so evident. And it was that picture of the men. And the still picture doesn't do it justice. When you start to get the video of their faces and their expressions and some of the language that they use, that I think, and, you know, and the, to me, you know, people say, why a film after 20 years? It's because and to really understand it, you have to capture it with the visuals. You've got to capture it with the sound and the things that are going on in that room. And the fact that I am sitting there in that blue dress, you know, with a 35-year-old person. And I felt and I looked pretty small. And they were sort of in there sitting elevated above me, kind of looking down on me. But you can't capture that necessarily, even in a conversation, and you see it, and it is important, and it hit people that day, and that's why they went out in 1992 and got six women in the Senate, and that's why we are, in part, why we are today with 20.
There are a couple of moments that are really, I think, were really interesting for me, and it kind of confused me in some ways. There's a moment in the film, for example, where Joe Biden, of course, now vice president, then it was the Democratic senator, and he was the ranking member, the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, of course, conducting all of the proceedings. And he's questioning you. And now, mind you, as a Democrat, I suppose we would assume that he was sympathetic, and maybe, in fact, he was. But I don't know what to make now in retrospect, hearing the questioning now. I don't know what to make of the fact that he seemed intent, Professor Hill, on getting you to say all the dirty words.
Right.
That was really kind of disturbing. And what did you make of that?
And I think if you watch a film, you'll hear over and over, well, tell us again.
Yes.
Say it again. And that's the thing that in real time, I don't think I quite felt that it was just – there was so much of a push to just keep talking about these things. And I think Joel Abramson and Jane Meyer in the film have their own interpretation of why that was happening, what they were trying to do. In the moment, what you're doing is you're just trying to respond, at least what I was just trying to respond. And so – but again, that I think came from the lack of awareness and understanding. But that was a choice in some ways, because I know for a fact of at least
a choice
two,
from Senator Biden, you mean?
Well, it's a choice of all of them to the level of information that they were willing to display about the issues that I was raising wasn't choice, because I know for a fact that there were experts who were available to help them have better questions and make more informed choices, or to testify themselves about how the public should be hearing what I was talking about, mm-hmm. and what the experience in the workplace was for many women. And so, you know, if you're disappointed, I think you have a right to be disappointed. I think there are a lot of people who will be disappointed. Some of that kind of gets lost in the years since. But I think Anita, the film, brings it back to us. And now we understand better why we were disappointed.
Yeah. You mentioned Jill Abramson and Jane Mayer, two reporters who've written about this.
Yes.
Jane with the New Yorker, Jill with the executive editor of the New York Times now. Frieda Mock, how do you understand what was going on there? Was this I think Jane and Jill give some sense that in some way it was almost strategic.
Well,
the idea was to humiliate her, make her say these things over and over and over again.
Well, I feel like I'm the typical American public just watching television at that moment, and I didn't really, as I said, understand all the dynamics because it was a political as it turns out, it was a very politically charged, strategically developed campaign, which I feel the book really illuminated. I mean, they did 3 years of research and talked to everyone, hundreds of interviews, and carefully constructed a factual accounting of that whole period, particularly that weekend. And it really was the basis on which I felt I as a public understood better, and I felt through their participation in the film helps all of us as an audience member understand what really was going on. I didn't know there was this White House camp. I, you know, I read the paper back then, but you know, I wasn't really aware of all that. I think we were just so – I was amazed by the sensationalism of what was – of the testimonies both on both sides. And so –
And I just wanted to add, because you talked about Joe Biden, who's a Democrat, and you say, well, you would assume that there was some sympathy. But when it came right down to it, when confronted with this issue, these were powerful men. They didn't even know they were men. They just thought they were people. They were men who had been living through this male perspective. And and I think when people heard it, when they said, explain again, there were women who were saying, what don't you understand
right.
about this?
Right.
and in reality, perhaps they didn't understand it because they had been living in such privilege, in such power. They didn't understand the sense of disempowerment that these experiences evoke, and it transcended the politics of Democrat and Republican, even though, you know, it sort of sorted itself out in that way. But what was more important when they got this testimony was, oh gosh, this shakes up our world, and not only just in political sense, but in the sense of how we live our lives every day. And they didn't want that to be shaken up. They didn't want to relinquish that and have to sort of invite in a different kind of conversation.
Yeah, actually, as part of that, too, you know, there were laws on the book. There were about sexual harassment. In fact, the Supreme Court in 1986 had declared what is sexual harassment, how to define it, as that activity which creates a hostile environment. And yet these laws were actually not applicable to the senators. They were immune from those laws. So. Mm-hmm.
Well, they have been immune for and continued immunity even after the hearing.
Yes, so that it didn't apply.
I think what was interesting too in the film is the intensity of the reaction. We won't play it, but there's a moment that Alan Simpson is extraordinary. But here's a moment that we pulled from the actual hearing itself. This is Orrin Hatch in a moment when Senator Biden has. Sort of laid out the rules of how Professor Hill's statement would be used in the hearings. And you've talked about Frieda Mock remembering hearings Orrin Hatch. Let me play this and have you talk about it, because it's extraordinary the intensity that's going on.
I just want to say something for the record here. This is not the appointment of a justice of the peace. This is the nomination process for the man to become Supreme Court Justice of the United States. And he's been badly maligned. And I might add that I have a lot of sympathy for Professor Hill, too. But I'm not going to sit here and tolerate her attorneys telling you or me or anybody else that now that she's made these statements in writing with what is, if the judge is telling the truth, and I believe he is, scurrilous allegations. That
statement can't... So you remember that, Freedom Hawk? You remember those moments?
Yeah, even more, though. I think it was Saturday morning, you know. I was just had my headphones on. I was running, and I didn't even see the image of his, you know, waving that book or whatever. It was stunning. It was so memorable. What did someone do in this and to engender this incredible wrath? It was amazing. And I think when you think of what we used in the film, I mean, what were her chances of being heard truthfully when you have Ellen Sampson, like McCarthy, saying, I have in my pocket, you know, like I have these names, or in this case, I have affidavits and faxes. And then saying, you know, we can't seem to get to the truth of this because we have to tolerate this sexual harassment crap.
Crap was the word
he used. Yeah. Crap. I said that was hopeless. How could she be heard with a man of that kind of position? And also where there was another moment. But anyway, Senator Spector saying, well, you know, I'm going to talk about large breasts. You know, this is what
that's not so bad.
That's not so bad.
Yeah.
Oh, my heavens. You know, what were the chances of her being heard rationally?
But we should say, of course, as those who maybe recall it, and it's in the film, there is that moment where you return. You didn't seem terribly cowed by Senator Spector. I mean, you gave back.
Well, I did, because it seemed so evident to me, and I think this is where being a law professor and being a lawyer kind of came in.
Yeah.
You knew the game that he was playing, and in so many ways, I consider myself at fortunate for being the person who I was and the age that I was at the time. Because if I had been younger, if I hadn't had legal training, or if I hadn't, you know, spent years in the classroom debating things and understanding the way these exchanges go, I think it would have been a different kind of outcome. But no, you can't. At some point, you have to say you can be deferential to the process. You know that this is an important event, but at some point, it does become personal. And then you just have to say, listen, again, I will try to explain it and you will hear me. And I'm not sure that he ever heard. But then what I didn't realize at the time was that I was creating a record and that I was going on record and explaining. And there were people who did hear.
Yes.
Anita Hill is with us. She's a professor of social policy law and women's studies at Brandeis University. Freedom Mock is a filmmaker, director, writer, and producer, director of the new documentary. It's called Anita. Tonight at 6:30, it's screening at the Salt Lake City Library Theater this coming Saturday in Park City as well. There are waiting lists for both of those screenings, we should mention. For more information, go to our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're back in Park City for another conversation about a documentary at the Sundance Film Festival. We're here at the community radio station KPCW, speaking with Professor Anita Hill. There's a film that tells her story, how in 1991 she came forward to testify about the behavior of Clarence Thomas, who had been nominated, of course, for the Supreme Court. Hill confronted an all-white, all-male judiciary committee. It was a surreal moment, and it revealed a lot about the American cultural landscape. Her testimony, of course, ignited a media firestorm, and it changed gender politics in this country. The film we're talking about, again, is called Anita, and the director, Freedom Mock, is with us, and, of course, Professor Hill is with us as well. And I should mention, we'll be mentioning some of the screenings. We have them on our website, links to them as well. But we'll mention those a little bit later in the program. Professor Hill, I wanted to ask you say in the film you didn't want this to be a political witch hunt. And I guess you figured this would all be confidential, but you had to make a statement. You wanted to write something out. So I guess I was curious about at what point – what was the turning point when you decided, all right, I think this is going to be difficult, but I have to say something. Was there a particular moment?
The statement that I sent in was sent to the chairman, to Senator Biden. And then, as people may recall, that it was leaked to the press. And we still don't know how it was leaked or why, but it was leaked. And the question then became, well, now that you have a statement, it's been leaked, what am I going to do now? What happens next? I think there were options at that point. There was a lot of pressure on the Senate to reopen the hearings and to have a public hearing. What I thought was going to happen when I sent the statement in was that there was going to be some investigation and that there would be further questioning. That didn't happen, and it wasn't happening until the leak happened. And so that's when the process started to move forward. I completely lost control of it. And then I had a choice, I suppose, then to say, you know what? I'm not going to go any further with this.
Yeah. Because you knew the circumstance. You would have to be there in front of them.
I knew then at that point that if there was going to be a hearing, that it was going to be a public hearing. But I also had an idea that they weren't really going to fully investigate it. It was going to be more like the trial that it turned out to be. And so I had a choice. And that's when some people came and began to help me figure out how to make the best of what I knew I had to do, which was to continue to move forward with it and to go forward and testify. There was a subpoena issued.
Yeah.
But I think, ironically, I think that what they really were trying to do was to give me time enough before they actually issued the subpoena to give me time to say, well, you know, you can get out of this, you can back out of this yourself. And I didn't do that. I did go ahead and test. I don't know how you prepare for it.
Yeah.
Did you make the choice?
Well, you did say in the film, you said, I just realized I had to be focused. Mm-hmm. I guess that was it, right? Just
to be focused, and to be honest, there were people then who volunteered. A woman named Emma Coleman Jordan called me on the phone. She and Susan Della Ross were two law professors, basically, who said, look, we're going to put together a group of people who can help advise us through this process. Mm-hmm. And then people came together. One of the clips you said, we're not going to listen to her lawyers tell us X, Y, and Z, as though I had some kind of team that was, you know, geared up and ready to bring me forward. Well, these were people who just sort of came together because they saw that I was really going into this lion's den. And so they came and they helped me. They helped me to understand and to ask me the questions that I might anticipate being, or to help me anticipate the questions that I might be asked. And then for myself, though, I had to decide what the charge to myself was. And that was to say what had happened to me, the behavior that I had experienced, the things that Clarence Thomas had done and said, and how they impacted me, how they felt, and why, to convey in that why it was inappropriate, and especially for the position, as Orrin Hatch says, we're not talking about justice of peace here.
Yeah.
We're talking about somebody sitting on the Supreme Court in a lifetime appointment, for an entire lifetime. And as we see in the next few years after the hearings, he was deciding some of the same kinds of cases, sexual harassment cases that came to the Supreme Court. And he was a vote in those cases. And I think it then started to become apparent to people why the testimony was important.
I want to play a moment, if you don't mind, from your testimony, because I wanted to get you to react to when you see it in the film and when you hear it. This was a moment, again, October 1991, Professor Anita Hill.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Thurman, members of the committee, my name is Anita F. Hill, and I am a professor of law at the University of Oklahoma. I was born on a farm in Okmulgee County.
And I want to play another moment here, too. You started really personal. I thought that was interesting.
Because in the days before my testimony, there had been so much of an effort. I mean, the campaign, the opposition campaigns had already started to sort of present me as this kind of crazed or irrational human being who was some kind of zealot who was coming forward for no good reason and trying to change this, to destroy Clarence Thomas. And that's what the portrayal was. And I at least had a moment that I wanted them to know who I was. And it sounds a little odd when I say my name is Anita F. Hill. And I use the initial because for most of my life and most of my family refer to me by my middle name.
Huh.
And so that was very personal to use that initial. And I looked and I listened to it in the film, and I thought, oh, it must sound so weird for someone to say my name's Anita F. Hill. But that was also just sort of recapturing for me that person who I was and am to people who were viewing me as this kind of demon who was coming forward to destroy this process.
Here's another moment.
During this period at the Department of Education, my working relationship with Judge Thomas was positive. I had a good deal of responsibility and independence. I thought he respected my work and that he trusted my judgment. After approximately 3 months of working there, he asked me to go out socially with him. What happened next and telling the world about it are the two most difficult experiences of my life. It is only after a great deal of agonizing consideration and great number of sleepless nights that I am able to talk of these unpleasant matters to anyone but my close friends.
What do you think when you hear that? You're hearing, of course, 35-year-old woman from your former self. Mm-hmm. Are you hearing nervousness? Does it bring back the memories of it when you hear back?
I can hear the anxiety in my voice. I can hear the fact that I really didn't know. I had, tried to prepare in just a very few days, a very short period of time, to grab my belongings, get to Washington, D.C., and then try to settle myself into this. But I didn't know what was going to happen next. Honestly, I did not know that it was going to be the ordeal that it was. But I was, and so there was the apprehension. But I did want to know, that let people know that this was not something that I had just decided to do when woke up and said, okay, I'm going to go to Washington and testify. It was a difficult choice to come forward and to continue with the hearings. And I thought it was important for people to know that. I thought I had been dehumanized before by the process. And they needed to know that there was a human being in the room and that a life was being affected by what was they were about to see.
Charles Ogletree, a Harvard professor, he seemed like an incredible stalwart friend during all of this. And there's an interesting element in the film. We don't need to say too much about it, but he talks about how he was the only black man there too. Frida Mock, do you want to say something about that? That's an interesting.
Yeah, I thought extremely interesting because I didn't know all the complexities. I was very aware of a certain controversy within the African American community by what she was doing. But for him to say that I was the only black man among her volunteer attorneys said a lot, and he tells us why. He, first of all, believed that he wanted to be a part of her staff and to guide her and help her, because he believed in what she was saying, and he believed her. And so he said it was very important for him to be there by her side and represent the African-American community, an aspect of it.
And there were a couple of African-American women who were also law professors, Kimberly Crenshaw and Tanya Banks, who had actually gone out and tried to get more support from African-American males. And you know, they sort of taken an approach that they didn't want to touch the subject. It, as far as Charles Ogletree is concerned, I have to say that when he did come forward, it wasn't without some risk. He was also a law professor at the time, but he was coming. He was on the verge of being either tenured or not getting tenured at Harvard Law School. And for whatever we think about whether the Northeastern Harvard being liberal versus conservative, it is a traditional place. And you know, they have their traditions, and it's not always accepting of things that go outside of the convention. So this was a risky move on his behalf, as well as the other witnesses, and you see them in the film. The other witnesses were taking a risk by coming forward and being a part of this. And I will be eternally grateful that they decided as well that this is important for us to do. And I think they decided it, one, for personal reasons because of that, of me. But I also think they decided it as well because they're all lawyers and they understood the importance of the court. Hmm.
Yeah, and I was struck by that they actually were speaking truth to power as well, that they felt that they thought this was the right thing to do. There was a professional risk because they were all mid-career and tenure issues were coming up or public appointments as a judge. You know, these are all issues. And the opposition had, thick dossiers on each of the corroborating witnesses. So they were doing – they were ready for – battle. And yet they were coming there to say, this is what I know to be the truth.
And my job was threatened. I was a tenured professor. Yeah. My job was threatened.
The dean of your law school was threatened?
The dean, there was pressure for him to resign and from state legislators. But if you think about it, each of those people, one was a corporate attorney. So his client base might be threatened. Wow. One individual was working, I believe, for the city. People can be fired for doing things that are unpopular. And let's not forget that immediately after the hearing, there was a poll taken, and 7 out of 10 people said that they thought I had perjured myself. So it was an unpopular position that they took because they believed that it was the right thing to do. And they've suffered consequences as well.
Mm-hmm. Charles Ogletree says in the film that after all of this, when all of this goes, he says, so he goes back to Harvard, you go back to Oklahoma, and he wondered, he says in the film, how this would affect you. And he says he realized that you were going to be okay, that you seemed to now have gained some larger perspective that people come to understand, that people will come to understand this story, that they will come to figure it out eventually. Talk about that. What does he mean? Did you have some sense that it was going to be okay as you left?
I think my immediate reaction when I returned home, I did think that I was shocked when I walked into the room, and you see the scene in the film where I walk into the room and there are all of these people who are supporting me.
This is back in Oklahoma,
and there are all these people who are supporting me. And after a weekend of sort of being sequestered and being vilified, I felt pretty isolated. Yeah. And then to be in that room where it was really like returning home. And so that was quite a shock. And so I think it did help to restore that things are going to be all right. There are, you may not be the majority of people who are supporting you, but there are people who will be there for you. And I found that to be true, especially among many of my law school colleagues, or most of my law school colleagues, that support continued. Charles says he instantly knew things were going to be all right and that I was going to be all right. No, there were some moments when I started to feel like I might not be all right. Yeah. and I think it took a while for me to get there. But I will say that my mom, my mother, who turned 80 the day on October 16, 1991, which is the day after the vote or the day of the vote for Thomas's confirmation. My mom, if ever I thought I wasn't going to be all right, she sort of shook me back to my reality and helped me to understand that I would be and that that I was made of something that would get me through it.
And I think that's really powerful for the audience because that people
this
do
is an
ask,
important part of the film, we should say,
exactly.
For Ida Mock, is the personal part.
Yeah, the personal part is that people always wonder, how do you do it? Because it's a mirror to ourselves. If we were in the same circumstances, how would we get through this? And I noticed people ask her questions in public. These are kind of fundamental questions. You know, how do you survive that? How did you get through that? And it goes back, as I can see, and I think the story shows, that it's her family, how she was raised. An amazing family.
Well, and home, which I want to get to when we get back from a break. Before we do that, I have to ask about the voicemail left by Clarence Thomas's wife, Virginia, because it does come up in the film. It's so strange. But it also seems in some ways, Anita Hill, kind of revealing. What did that reveal to you about that moment, if you even want to say anything about it, which I respect and understand if you don't?
But let me just say that it reveals that I think some of the things that Frieda saw, that there still is an energy, a desire for people to know what was going on. And that really, not just from the voicemail, but from the reaction of people. I mean, it was, I couldn't believe how many phone calls and email messages I got in response to that voicemail, where people still want to know and they still feel very strongly about those hearings. They want to know the answers. And they were outraged that Mrs. Thomas would send that message. But I think the response, again, to it was what really tells me that there are still people who want to know the answers, and the issues raised are not dead. They're still with us.
Anita Hill is a professor of social policy, law, and women's studies at Brandeis University. Her latest book is called Reimagining Equality. Frieda Mock is with us, filmmaker, director, writer, and producer. Her film, she directed the film Anita, which premiered on Saturday. There are two more screenings during Sundance, and we'll give you the details about that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take another brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're back at the community radio station KPCW. We're talking about another documentary at the Sundance Film Festival, the documentary called Anita. And we're here with Professor Anita Hill. Frieda Mock, the filmmaker who directed the film, is also with us. So the film is about Anita Hill, of course, but I wanted to ask you, Frieda Mock and you, Anita Hill, too, about a young girl named Emily Carpenter, I think is her name,
yes,
who kind of steals the show towards the end. I have to say she's a remarkable young lady.
Absolutely.
Say something about this, because this is where the film also turns here as well, and you get this sort of transition from one generation to another.
Absolutely. And the issue is 20 years later, where are we? Where is Professor Anita Hill? Where are we as a country on certain of the issue that she raised about sexual misconduct in the workplace? And it was wonderfully absolutely inspiring to discover out of the 20th anniversary Hunter College event, which was attended by veterans of the movement and also the next generation, that there were impressive groups of young women who have created nonprofit organizations to deal with harassment beyond the workplace.
Yeah.
It was harassment on the streets and in a particular harassment in the schools and trying to do something to educate the next generation about what they can do to preclude what actually had happened to Anita, 20, 30 years ago.
So did Emily Carpenter, you had said something in the film where you felt like we were on the verge of something monumental and profound. Emily's probably who you have in mind in some ways.
Absolutely. We have a generation of women who, young women and girls, who are so articulate. They understand what it takes, what they need in order to feel a sense of equality in society, so much more so than what we did, or at least I, maybe Frieda, not, but certainly not myself. I just didn't even have the words to be able to talk about what I needed to feel that I could be my best self. And they're getting there, and they know what we need, what changes need to be made. They are organized. Emily is a wonderful organizer and a great teacher and mentor.
Amazing.
And you see her in the film talking to younger girls and helping them to develop their voice. And so that, I think, is the legacy of these last 20 years and the work that is going on. And we know that they know that in order for us to truly feel equal, that sexual harassment is going to have to be eliminated. It's not going to be just enough to have laws on the books that, you know, will file complaints if there's a problem. They are expecting a world where it doesn't exist. So they're not going to be satisfied with just having the right to file a complaint. But we also know that they are going to identify issues that we haven't even begun to address, that they're going to be moving us forward even more. And I'll feel fortunate if I just live to see the things that they're going to be doing.
Anita Hill, she's the author of the book Speaking Truth to Power and Reimagining Equality, a professor of social policy, law, and women's studies at Brandeis University. Professor, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
And Frieda Mock, filmmaker, director, writer, producer. She directed the film Anita, which is tonight at 6:30. It's screening at the Salt Lake City Library. It's coming this Saturday to Park City. We'll give you details about those screenings on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Frieda Mock, thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the show directed today by KPCW's Mario Heeb. Thanks also to Michael Havey back at the studio at KUER. Radio West, produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.